Toyota, the number one consumer choice on the most fuel-efficient automaker, and now during Toyota's number one for a reason event, get 0.9% APR financing on a 2010 Prius.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tibet's Mount Kailash is a remote and mystical sacred place. It is considered holy to four religions. Thousands make the difficult pilgrimage to circle it each year. We follow one man's trek as he takes it all in and grapples with the meaning of life and death. This hour on Point, the mystery, the spiritualism, the future of Tibet. You can join the conversation. Have you traveled to Tibet's holy mountain? Have you taken a holy pilgrimage yourself? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later in the hour, we'll talk about the Dalai Lama stepping down as Tibet's political leader. But first, joining me now in San Francisco is award-winning travel writer Colin Thubron, who's previously written about his travels in the Middle East and in the Soviet Union. In his latest book, To a Mountain in Tibet, Thubron treks to the holiest mountain, Mount Kailash. Colin, welcome. Nice to have you with us.
Hi, Jane.
So the book opens with you traveling across northern Nepal toward Mount Kailash in this remote area of western Tibet. Help us understand why this 22,000-foot mountain in the Himalayas is so mystical, why it is so revered by so many.
Partly, I think, for its beauty and its strangeness. It's separated from the rest of the Himalaya and stands on its own as if it's been put there specially. It got associated with a mountain in Hindu scripture, which was the mystical heart of the world and the source of all creation. And the four great rivers of the Indian subcontinent all have their origins within about 70 miles of the peak of this Mount Kailash. So it's very strange. That's the northern source of the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, the Indus, the Sutlej. They all rise close to Kailash, which is a very strange geographical fluke, and I'm sure that contributed to its sanctity.
And are there any recorded attempts to climb Mount Kailash?
Only very feeble ones. There were a couple of British army officers who at different times thought that they might climb it, one with no more equipment than a furled umbrella, but they were dissuaded. It's too holy. It's never been climbed.
So explain the ritual of circling this holy mountain. It hasn't been climbed, but people do walk around it, correct?
Yes, this is quite typical of Hindu and Buddhist pilgrimage, that you don't ascend, let alone conquer, in the crude mountaineer's terminology. You go around in reverence, and they go around the base of this great mountain, which is 33, 34 miles around the base, and simply look up at it. The Buddhists can do it in 36 hours because of their lungs, the Tibetans. The Hindus and any Westerner are more likely to take 3 or 4 days.
Explain the journey then, your journey, how difficult it was.
Well, my journey started, I acclimatized very slowly by flying eventually in a little twin otter aircraft to a little place called Simikot in northwest Nepal, and from there walked up this very beautiful valley to the Tibetan border. That only took about 7-8 days. And by that time I'd already been up at about 15,000 feet, and so I didn't get altitude sickness. It was only the effort of climbing steeply up to an 18,600-foot pass at the base of Kailash that I suddenly felt a terrible sort of exhaustion. Mm. You really can't go fast then. You can't move very, very strenuously. You had to breathe deeply, walk slowly, and just hope not to get the awful altitude sickness, for which there's really no cure except to come back.
And in most spots, one wrong step, and you're in trouble.
There were parts, particularly in Nepal, when we were high above the Kanali River, when if you slipped, that would really be it. You'd tumble down into the abyss. But it's a very well-marked track and very beautiful, and I never felt in real danger there. The danger used to be in this area from Maoist guerrillas, but they too have gone.
How did you choose this particular location, Mount Kailash?
An Indian woman told me about it years ago and said how beautiful and strange it was. And I remember thinking, well, I'll never go there. And then my mother died, and I had no family suddenly at all. And I wanted to do something. I can't explain this very logically, but as if I wanted to take something like a pilgrimage, although I'm an agnostic.
You actually write about this in the book, and I wish you would read it for us, the motivation for taking this journey.
Yes. My Sherpa asked me, you know, why are you doing this, traveling alone? And I say here, I cannot answer. I am doing this on account of the dead. Sometimes journeys begin long before their first step is taken. Mine, without my knowing, starts not long ago in a hospital ward as the last of my family dies. There's nothing strange in this, the state of being alone. The death of parents may bring resigned sadness, even a guilty freedom. Instead, I need to leave a sign of their passage. My mother died just now, it seems, not in the way she wished. My father before her, my sister before that, at the age of 21. Time is unsteady here. Sometimes I am a boy again, trying to grasp the words never, never again. Humans, it is said, cannot comprehend eternity in time or space. We are better equipped to register the distance spanned by village drumbeat. The sheerness of never is beyond us. To ask of a journey why is to hear only my own silence. It is the wrong question, although there seems no other. Am I harrowing myself because the world is mortal? Whose pain am I purging? Not theirs. An old Tibetan monk tells me the soul has no memory. The dead do not feel their past. Meanwhile, the sun is setting with a perverse radiance behind us.
So at the death of your mother, you undertook this journey, and I know it's difficult to describe, but can you see now that you are finished what you wanted to accomplish by traveling and climbing and making this treacherous journey to Mount Kailash?
I'd love to give a narrative of some sort of epiphany or revelation. It wasn't quite like that. I'd conceived it more as a time out of my ordinary life and a journey of some meditation. I don't know quite what it did for me. It put me in contact with another way of looking at death and the hereafter, the Tibetan Buddhist way, which is very grand in a sense, in as much as they believe that an individual life simply adds or subtracts from the weight of good or evil in the world. It's a very different concept from anything in the Christian tradition to which I'm used, and it brings no comfort because they don't believe in any individual survival. So what I was doing, I think, was more a kind of testing of myself and a contemplation.
And so did that Buddhist way of thinking about death, did it change your way of thinking as an agnostic?
Not my way of thinking, no, I don't think so. But my way of feeling, perhaps. It made me think of my own life, perhaps, as less important than I had done in the grand scale of things. But that's almost all I can say, I think. It could offer no comfort because in Buddhism there's no soul and there's no God. It's not even a philosophy, as one Buddhist monk tells me. It's a kind of a science almost of meditation and of realizing how the world really is.
You speak of the Buddhist way of thinking. Along the way, I read that you observed pilgrims of various religions converging on Kailash, Mount Kailash. So you spoke of what you learned from the Buddhist tradition. What did you learn from all of these various faiths or their native beliefs and how they were converging in this really incredible place?
Well, one felt very moved by them. The great other tradition is the Hindu, and they believe that the mountain is sacred to Shiva, the great god of change and destruction. And they were coming up from the lowlands of India and rising to this huge mountain plateau at 15,000 feet and then on again to 18,600 feet, where several of them died while I was on the mountain. Eight of them died. It was so strenuous. What I learned from them really was a sort of extraordinary respect and fascination with their particular piety. Buddhism I found easier to grasp as a philosophy than Hinduism, easier to relate to, however austere. But with all these pilgrims, one was fascinated by the sheer tenacity of their faith and what they would do in its service.
From the pilgrims to the monasteries and the shrines and the cemeteries that you visited en route, in the book you talk about your discovery that Tibet had barely recovered, or has barely recovered, from the violence of China's Cultural Revolution. How so?
Yes, the Cultural Revolution simply wiped out all the monasteries. There were little monasteries around this mountain, four of them at the cardinal points of Mount Kailash. And the beautiful lake of Manasarovar, which lies underneath, which is the highest freshwater lake on earth of its size, at 15,000 feet, that had monasteries sprinkled around the shores as well. But all these, in this very remote part of Tibet, the Red Guards got even there and demolished them one by one. They had been rebuilt very tentatively and rather movingly. Almost all of them had sort of partially recovered.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're tagging along with travel writer Cullen Threwbron this hour. His latest book is To a Mountain in Tibet, which tells the tale of his journey to Tibet's holy mountain, Mount Kailash. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. I want to get a couple of calls in here. Let's go first to Bob in Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Bob. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for this wonderful show. I traveled there myself in 1996 and made the pilgrimage around Mount Kailash. Mm. And I think it's mysterious the way mountains like that call us to them. When I first read about it in a marvelous book called The Way of the White Clouds, I'm sure Mr. Tupdrone is familiar with, I was not a practicing Buddhist or familiar with it in any way. And as soon as I read his chapter on Mount Kailash, I immediately thought, like a lightning bolt, I must go there, and started researching it. And within 5 years, I was able to make the pilgrimage. And by that time, I had become a practicing Tibetan Buddhist.
It's so interesting, Bob, that notion of the mountain calling out to you. I got that sense in Colin's book. Would you talk about that, Bob's point, Mr. Threwbron?
Yes, it's so familiar to me. Mountains have been afraid of, basically, I think, ever since my sister was killed on one many years ago.
In an avalanche.
I've been reluctant.
Yeah.
Yes, I was 19, she was 21, and I've been reluctant to travel among mountains, really, ever since. And this was, in a certain way, perhaps a coming to terms with that, too. Unlike our guest, I did not feel a convert to Buddhism, but fascinated by it and respectful of it. I think mountains have always been associated with divinity, whether it's the Himalayas to the Hindus or the Mount Olympus to the ancient Greeks. And there's something about ascending that is cleansing. And one feels that quite viscerally that to be going up is to be in some way drawing closer to God.
Bob, thank you for that call. One of my favorite parts of your book, Mr. Threwbron, was that you seemed especially sensitive to the families that you encountered along your journey. You talk about meeting one family in the village of Tuling. You write that your traveling pack contained more than everything that family owned. You write, everything we have looks excessive. Can you speak to those people, especially those families that you met along the way that touched you?
They were desperately poor. They lived in these really delightful-looking villages of stone and timber close against the mountainside. They look perfectly beautiful. And this is, in a way, the traveller's dilemma, that it almost seems to be a condition of this picturesqueness, that people should be poor. And when you stay with these families, you realised how wretched their lives could be. They just had little fields of barley, or, if they were lucky, of rice. squashed in the river valley there. And many, unfortunately, were having to supplement their income by felling the beautiful trees that were all around them in the valley and taking them up by yak or pony to the border of Tibet, which is virtually treeless there, and selling them. But they were affecting families. What they really had realized was that their way out of this poverty was education, and they were desperate to get their children educated. Mm.
Read another section from your book, Mr. Thubron. Here's a description of a host that you met in the village of Yangar.
Yes, this was a family of these were more like Tibetan, ethnically Tibetan Nepalese people. And this was Dendu, our host. I simply write, Dendu, our host, is 40 and spry. He wears Western dress like all the village men, anoraks and shabby trousers made in China, and a peaked cap, blazoned Life Plus. His big, loose mouth gives him a deceptive air of languor. We scale a series of ladders, giddy flights of notched tree trunks, and stoop into rooms whose deep-framed windows leak in a dead, sunless light. Their floors, ceilings, and pillars are all of heavy sal wood, where the dents of axe and chisel still show, but embedded now to a sombre, burnished strength. Dendu says his father built this ancient-seeming keep. Its pillars drive down two or three floors to the rock, and its beams are patterned with white circles, native to Tibet. It was built for stocky mountaineers. Its furniture is thick and dwarfish. I bang my head on the door lintels. The low table looks like a bench, and the blundering Westerner sits down on it. Tolerantly, Dendu motions to the floor, and in the faded light we sit in a genial circle around their stove, where his wife bakes bread. She is too shy at first to speak. Her jet-black hair parts into pigtails round high-coloured cheekbones. The shelves behind her are banked with gleaming tins and thermoses, a clock and a gutted radio, and hung with polished ladles. She hands out milk fresh from their cow. Beside her, a bridal cupboard in Pompeian red is limned with faded flowers. She slaps the dough between her hands on and on, then smooths it on the hob to brown into thin bread, while Dendu pounds pickles in a wooden mortar.
Mm. Your descriptions are so vivid and beautiful. I wish you'd tell us the story of the young monk. You just described Dendu. Tell us the story of the young monk who was in exile, who could never return to Tibet. You met him along your journey. What was your interaction?
There were several such monks, and they the sadness was, would be that they had often come out leaving their families behind. This young monk, as a small boy, a 6 or 7 year old boy, had been taken by his rustic family from a little village in Tibet, handed over to strangers who presumably they paid something to. And with these strangers, he escaped into the freedom of Nepal. He there was able just occasionally to telephone his mother, who he had never see again. He said that he had reached a sort of freedom and a peace here, and that his family now was the monastery. My mother, my father, my brothers, they are all here, he said. They are the monks. And he was forever really cut off, he felt, from going back to see his real family.
And he met with his father, do I remember that correctly? Every
this
summer
was
for
another,
a couple of days?
Yes. This was another young monk who, on the border of Tibet, I saw taking over this very dignified and frail old man. And he said that his father lived in Tibet, he lived in Nepal. He was unable to go back to Tibet to see his father. But every year, his father would come down to the bridge and walk over the bridge with him, and they would spend a day or two just within Tibet, within Nepal, talking and remembering. And each year, he said, he wasn't sure if his father was going to be there.
Another moving passage of your book comes in the midst of your journey, and you come across a guidebook passage as you're climbing Mount Kailash. You spoke of your sister and how she had passed away in an avalanche when she was young. And here you are scaling Mount Kailash. You're reading this guidebook passage which compares the precipice of Mount Kailash, which is looming above you, to the mountain where your sister had died. I wish you'd tell us about that.
Yes, it was a strange fluke. Of course, if you travel with your family in mind, you will be reminded of them everywhere. But by a fluke, I was walking under the north face of Kailash on this great circuit, and the north face is terrible. It's absolutely sheer for 5,000 feet of precipitous cliff lined with ice. And the one little English-speaking guide to Kailash compared it to Mount Eiger, seen from Grindelwald in Switzerland. And Grindelwald was where my sister was killed. And I suppose in some unconscious way almost, this mountain was playing on my mind as I was going around it.
I have read that climbers at high altitude sometimes sense someone or a person walking a few paces behind them just out of sight. I've read many accounts of that. I'm curious if that happened to you.
It didn't. I have heard of it quite a lot, and a friend of mine really felt his father was walking just beside him for a long way. I didn't. I sometimes imagined that they were walking in front of me in a sort of valley just out of sight.
Colin Thubron, here's another call from Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Marcel is on the line. Marcel, welcome to On Point.
What wonderful memories, listening to your guest talking about his pilgrimage to Mount Kailas. I took that pilgrimage also in 1999, and I followed the same route that your guest took. And I have this great, great memory of climbing the mountain, especially that 18,000-foot-high pass. And as I was climbing and I was breathing very hard, trying to get my breath, and I looked in back of me at this Tibetan woman who was also climbing the mountain in back of me. And I was wearing this expensive Gore-Tex jacket and Gore-Tex hiking boots and a walking pole with the spring loader on the bottom to absorb my shock. And I looked back at her, this Tibetan woman back at me, and she's wearing this sweater with holes in it, and her sneakers, her KED sneakers had holes in it, and she stopped and backed at me, and she looked at me. I was going and repeating my mantra constantly over and over. And she looked at me, and she looked at my Gore-Tex jacket, looked at my hiking boots and all the paraphernalia that I was wearing. And she studied me, and as she looked at me, a smile came over her face, and she gave me a thumbs up. And when she gave me that thumbs up, I could feel this connection between just her and I and what we were doing together on that beautiful, beautiful pilgrimage that we're taking together.
What a wonderful memory and a great call, Marcel. Thank
quite,
you.
Yeah, thank you. That's absolutely familiar to me. So many of the Tibetan pilgrims going up were, by Western standards, not equipped at all, just in sandals and twirling prayer wheels and sometimes with children on their backs and dogs. It was very moving, amazing.
Who did you travel with?
I traveled with a Sherpa. I went British Raj style, almost with the minimum that you can out of Nepal, which was a cook who was from the Everest area, who had no trouble with the altitude at all, and with a Sherpa from near Kathmandu, who had more trouble than I did. He developed headaches, and I, who was fearful of altitude sickness, for some reason didn't.
Tell us about the sky burials that you found along the way.
This is something that's always fascinated the West, as Tibet is a sort of death-haunted culture, we feel. And one of the reasons is not just the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is probably the only Tibetan text anybody's read in the West, but this strange system of sky burials in which the dead, which is quite traditional and typical in Tibet, are not buried. The earth is terribly hard and frozen anyway. They're not buried, but they're cut up and their bones are pounded and they're fed to vultures. It seems grotesque to us, but to the Tibetans, this is a very pure way of death. They regard vultures as sacred, and the vultures, they say, never defecate on earth. They only do it in the air, and that when they die, they fly up towards the sun. And there the wind just takes them apart and they disappear. So this ritual of the sky master, as they call him, who cuts up the dead, is a very particular one, I think, to the Tibetans, and has a great deal of both sanctity and superstition around it. I went up to one of these plateaus, and the dead are meant to be dismembered and fed to these vultures very purely. There shouldn't be anything left of them. Mm. But I found old knives lying about and the arm bones of a human with blood and flesh still on them. So this was a very casual Sky Master. But normally I think they're very stringent.
Mm. Let me get another call in here from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Colin. I'm a scholar of Buddhism, and I teach a course at Stonehill College on pilgrimage, in which we look at Kailash, Lourdes in France, and Mecca. And one thing my students resonate with is the notion that pilgrimage is a model for living a meaningful life. And I wonder, Colin, when you were out there on the Kora going around Mount Kailash, what sort of broad lessons might you have learned about living a fulfilling life that you could share with us listening today?
That's a very interesting and challenging question, and I wish I could answer it with great positive elan. One thing I felt, which was more to do with death, I think, that what pilgrimage does or meant to me to some extent was that you are taken away from your normal home. You leave everything behind you, and you're on the move. And in that way, I think by recognizing that your home is only a temporary dwelling, pilgrimage can be literally a preparation for death. And at my age, I'm 70, I was put in mind more of the transience of my own life, and that put it into some perspective.
Hmm. You describe, Colin Thubron, Tibet as, quote, less a country than a region in the mind, particularly for Western visitors. Do you think it will always have this sort of mystique, especially for Westerners, and why?
I don't know. Tibet in the 19th century in particular was a forbidden land. It was very hard to get into. Westerners entered it in disguise or secretly. A great mystique brewed up around it, which went on way into the 20th century, which was partly to do, I think, with the Tibetan Buddhism, the mystique around Buddhism. It was imagined that there were the Lungpa wind men who floated over the landscape almost without touching it, that their monks levitated and flew and broke rocks with the sound of their voices alone, so on. All this mystique brewed up about Tibet, and it was partly that it was so inaccessible, and partly that the West so longed, as it reeled through a couple of world wars in the last century, to place its fantasies somewhere, its ideal that there was a pure land somewhere. And Tibetan Buddhism, instead of being decried as it was in the 19th century as a sort of decadent leftover of the real Buddhism, began to be seen as something that had been preserved in a kind of pristine purity in this very remote area, as if time had stopped there. And this was the pure faith. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We've been talking about Tibet this hour, and now we're going to turn our attention to the Dalai Lama. You can join the conversation, listeners. What does the Dalai Lama mean to you? Do you think Tibet will benefit from some secular leadership? You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Thursday, the Dalai Lama announced he is stepping down as Tibet's political leader. Yesterday, he formally resigned to the Tibetan parliament in exile in Dharamsala, India. He will continue on as a spiritual leader of the Tibetan people.
Since the 1960s, I've repeatedly stressed that Tibetans need a leader elected freely by the Tibetan people to whom I can devolve power. Now we've clearly reached the time to make this happen.
We have travel writer Colin Thubron with us. His new book is To a Mountain in Tibet. And joining me now from Tokyo, Japan, is Evan Osnos, China correspondent for The New Yorker. Usually based in Beijing, in October, Evan profiled the Dalai Lama on the occasion of his 75th birthday. Evan, welcome to you. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Glad to be here.
So for your in-depth profile in The New Yorker last October, how much time did you spend with the Dalai Lama?
Well, I sort of roamed around the planet trying to keep up with him, which is not always as easy as it sounds. I went to the U.S. first, saw him in Indiana as he spoke to a series of crowds in a couple of cities, and then went to came back and went to see him in India. Over the course of a couple of days, he did his birthday party, and there were some celebrations surrounding that. And then, of course, I spent time with him there at his house. And then, in a sense, though, part of the process of writing about him is writing about the role that his absence plays to the Tibetan people inside China. So that meant spending time with the Tibetans and trying to get a feel for what role he plays for them, which is substantial.
And so, well, what is that role? I mean, what does his resignation mean for Tibet and the broader community?
Well, in a sense, you have to separate the political effect from the spiritual and sort of abstract effect. The political effect is, I think, actually significant. And what I mean by that, and that's actually, you know, it tends to be these days that what people are saying is that this is not going to have an immediate effect on the Tibet issue. And I think that's right, not immediately. He's been saying for years he wants to pull himself out of the daily management of the Tibetan diaspora. But over the long term, what he's now indicated is that he wants to establish a secular leadership, a political, independent secular leadership of the Tibetan community. And but, you know, he is and he remains the head of he's the spiritual head of the Tibetan world. And, you know, his name in Tibetan, people call him the Presence. And that hasn't changed since he's announced the plans to retire. And he will remain the Presence as long as he's around.
So what happens next, then, with the political leadership in Tibet? I mean, I'm looking at the three candidates, or three of the candidates in this election, very different profiles from the Dalai Lama. One is a legal scholar, a Tibetan legal scholar at Harvard, another a professor of Tibetan studies at Stanford, another is the Dalai Lama's current representative to Europe. So obviously these are very different kinds of people. What will change?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, at the moment, the person who is in that role, the current prime minister, is in fact a cleric. He's somebody who wears robes and has been a longtime friend and associate of the Dalai Lama's. And so this is going to be the first time that we've got candidates for that position who are from outside the religious tradition. And that means something significant. If the face of the Tibetan diaspora is now somebody who is going around the world looking more like a diplomat rather than a spiritual figure, that changes things a bit. And I think it's not going to be immediate, because the fact is that while all of these candidates are qualified, and some of them are well-known figures abroad for people interested in Tibet affairs, the truth is that they don't have the personal stature that he does, and they'll have to build that up over time.
So, Colin Thubron, how do you see it, having been there and experienced this firsthand as well? What will change for the people in Tibet, do you think, with the Dalai Lama stepping down?
Well, I agree that initially I think nothing very much. They're still going to conceive of him as their presence, as their leader, and nothing can change that. The Dalai Lama is the spiritual leader, and Tibetan culture is Buddhist. What I wonder, and maybe this can be answered now, is what the actual motive of the Dalai Lama is in taking this step, whether perhaps he's even a little tired. You know, he's been consistently putting a case to the Chinese that he wants limited autonomy within Tibet for his people. They've consistently stonewalled him. And I was wondering whether he's sending some sort of signal that the secular and the spiritual are in fact separate and the one is more important than the other.
Evan, what do you think?
I think that's exactly right. He's been trying for a number of years to withdraw from his political role, and I think that's because he realizes that essentially there's nobody in the Tibetan community who has the stature to disagree with him, and that's not a healthy way to build a democracy, which is what he's trying to do. And I think he also realizes that he has to plan for the future. I mean, as he told me, he expects to, he could live another 25 or 30 years. He was sort of meaning it half jokingly, but perhaps not. I mean, what he means is, I will not be here. And he talks about that a lot. He says, I will die. And what we need to do is prepare the Tibetan world for that. And this is the next step in the process. This is not the first thing he's done to try to prepare them for that. He's been talking about it in much more visible ways in recent years. But this is a step, and it was one that I think he realized he could take now, and people would start to get their minds around it before it becomes a more urgent necessity.
Evan Osnos, I really enjoyed your piece in The New Yorker, and I am curious what struck you personally after spending so much time with the Dalai Lama. What struck you personally about him, about his character traits, about who he is as a person?
You know, the thing about him that is striking is the degree to which he can broadcast to different audiences in different ways and have an effect on them. And what I mean is, I saw him in Indianapolis one day. He was giving a talk at a stadium there, which is a stadium that usually has country singers and basketball games, and there he is talking to a crowd, and somebody asked him a question, and a woman asked him a question. She was a dog trainer who said, how do I manage the anger in my life that I have towards my ex-husband? And he listened to the question, and, you know, somebody might say, well, you know, what does the Dalai Lama possibly have to contribute on that subject? He's a secular man who took a vow of celibacy when he was a child, and he's from Tibet. But actually, what he was able to do is, in the course of about two sentences, he managed to go from the Tibetan experience, as he put it. He said, you know, we lost our country, those are his words, and yet we've managed to build a life for ourselves that has meaning. And all of us, in some ways, who are facing adversity, have to do that for ourselves. And I spoke to this woman afterwards, and she was beaming. And that, for her, resonated. And I found that kind of remarkable for somebody coming from as far away as he is.
I also found the more humorous parts of him to be so interesting. Holding hands with heads of state, you know, extolling the importance of oral hygiene, brushing your teeth and such. He's got a personality, yeah. Quite a sense of humor as well.
Well, he seems to be, he's sort of strenuously attuned to making other people feel at ease. I mean, one of his brothers often says that people who meet Tibetans suffer from a sort of what he calls a Shangri-La syndrome, which is that everybody immediately gets extremely reverential and treats everybody like spun glass, and it gets in the way of meaningful discussion. And the Dalai Lama is constantly trying to cut through that, and he wants people to get down to business. So the first thing he does usually when he sits down with you is, you know, slaps you on the hand, try to get you to relax, make you think this is a normal conversation. Let's try to get some work done. Hmm.
Evan Osnos, joining us from Tokyo today. Thank you very much for your time and your insights.
My pleasure.
Evan Osnos is China correspondent for The New Yorker. He wrote an in-depth profile of the Dalai Lama for the October issue called The New Incarnation. As the Dalai Lama turns 75, what is Tibet's future? Mr. Thubron, I'm curious, the question of why you chose to climb Mount Kailash and spend so much time in Tibet is a complex one, and I know we've talked about it this hour. Did you experience any sense of peace after this rigorous journey to a nearly inaccessible place? And I know there were so many parallels in your own life with this journey. What happened when you were finished?
I'd love to be able to say that there was a neat narrative of having had some kind of epiphany. It wasn't quite like that. I came back with a more spacious sense of my own place in the world and perhaps the place of individuals that I loved in the world. A little bit more of acceptance. I can't say I was comforted, but the Tibetan tradition, the Buddhist tradition about the hereafter, is a very austere one, but it's very, very grand. And there, the burden of it is to say that what matters is the weight of good and evil in the world of karma, not the survival of the individual. They say that there's nothing more natural than that bodies and minds that decay should pass on into some other state or into nothingness. It's a very hard lesson to have confronted, but I think I came a little bit closer to some sort of acceptance of that rather than as I suppose deep in myself I had hoped, to feel that there was some kind of individual survival.
Here's another call from Fairview, Tennessee. Stuart is on the line. Hi, Stuart. Welcome to On Point.
Jane, thank you for hosting this wonderful guest.
Well, thank you. He is terrific.
So
go ahead with your question.
To speak to you, Mr. Thruon, I'll set this up as quickly as I can because I know there's a time constraint. But I first would like to say that I sense in you, sir, a genuine humility, which I admire greatly and strive for myself, and we'll see what happens in my lifetime. Thank you so much. Here's my question.
You
have studied intimately several religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, which are relatively ancient and mass practiced in the world history of religion. Here in this country, Christianity is, let's say, middle age. I don't know how you would portray that. But we seem in this country to have a fear of Islam. Does that occur in the religions you experienced around Nepal? And can you speak as an agnostic, is there any sense of comparing the youth of Christianity? I don't know. I'm not sure how to articulate this, but I hope you can take it from there and get what I'm driving at. Is it an immature thing that Christians are doing or typical around the world of religions? Does that make any sense?
Oh, a very hard question, a very big one. There's no Islam in the area that I was traveling in. It belongs in a very different tradition. You could say, and I know this will sound rather crass, that Islam and Christianity and Judaism belong in a certain tradition in which belief is, so what they believe is of crucial importance, what a Christian, you might say, has faith in. The Hindu-Buddhist tradition, which is everything that's practiced around Kailash, including the Jain, who are a peaceable sort of sect, a little like the Hindu. This tradition is more in how you are and what you realize. The Buddhist tradition, particularly the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, is really seeing, although it's very ethically inclined also, it's seeing the world as illusion. At its most developed, this philosophy, you might call it, is about realizing the illusoriness of all things, and that nirvana, there hereafter, is not a state of individual bliss so much as some kind of diffusion into a great, we would think, a great nothingness. They would not call it quite that. I'm not answering your question very well. Islam, of course, is a much younger religion, younger than Christianity. But like Christianity, it is very much posited on what you believe, what you have, if you like, a sort of intellectual, mental faith in. Mm-hmm. And Buddhism's not like that. It's in a certain way more gentle, because of the belief in constant reincarnations. It's more relaxed in a way. It's not like Christianity and Islam, in which we just have one life in which to prove ourselves, in which to gain enlightenment. It's more relaxed.
Understood. I want to get one last call in here. Rebecca is in Norfolk, Virginia. Rebecca, the time is short, but I wanted to squeeze you in. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call. I was listening to your guest talk about his pilgrimage, and I took a pilgrimage to Tibet in October of 2006 after surviving what would have been terminal cancer. And I was resonating with what he was talking about in terms of, the travel, the way that we traveled, getting the Sherpa and the cook and so forth, and meeting the people who were a very happy people. They were so happy, and this, my entire sense of, just being appreciative for what I have, it just changed my entire outlook, because they were very uncomplaining, very, very, very loving, happy people, which really struck me in the midst of great poverty. And I had a beautiful experience, even though I'm not Buddhist, I'm Roman Catholic. I think anyone can go there, and you get this wonderful sense of, again, being able to live your life more meaningfully after you have that experience. It was just a beautiful experience. I don't know how to put it in 2 minutes.
You did. Thank you very much, and I'm glad you called. Take care. Colin Thubron, final thought here as we close out this hour.
Well, thank you for sharing that to the person that's just spoken. Yes, the Tibetans have an astonishing vitality, I think. And yes, it seems to be a happiness in spite of everything that's happened to them over many centuries, in a way, not just this last century, which, of course, has been the most terrible. There was an Arab geographer years ago, 1,000 years ago, who said that beyond the Himalayas, there were these people who smiled even in adversity, even in mourning.
Colin Thubron, what a wonderful hour. Thank you so much for being with us, sir.
Thank you very much.
Colin Thubron is award-winning travel writer and author. His new book is To a Mountain in Tibet. For an excerpt, go to our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.